Welcome to The Water Table, the podcast that floats slowly, spreads widely, and sinks deeply into conversations about the human relationship with land, water, and community. I'm your host, Pete Dineen. Our guest today is Martha Davis. Martha retired in late 2017 from her leadership position at the Inland Empire Utilities Agency, a municipal water district serving 830,000 people in the western portion of San Bernardino County. Since 2000, Martha has led many of the agency's award-winning conservation, planning, and green programs, including initiatives promoting water efficiency, renewable energy, stormwater capture, and recycled water. She currently serves on the boards of the Mono Lake Committee, the Sierra Institute for Community and Environment, and the Community Water Center. Martha studied human biology at Stanford University and received her master's from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Martha, welcome to The Water Table.
Thank you for inviting me to be here today.
The other voice you will hear in the podcast today is that of water conservation legend Tom Ash, who passed away earlier this year. Tom was a horticulturalist who spent 3 decades in public water and was a leader in believing what you do in your backyard can make a difference. Martha, before we get to reflecting on the interview we did with your good friend Tom, we'd like to open the conversation with what is happening in California right now. The state is experiencing an intense summer of climate-driven impacts. Conversations are coming up, or will be in the coming months, about how we mitigate fire, drought, and water scarcity, how we build resilience to these impacts. Now, you've said before you see water resilience starting at the community level as opposed to top-down. What exactly do you mean by water resilience, and how does it start at home?
When I think about water resilience, I think about what are our human needs for water, but I also think of where the water comes from and what are our environmental needs for water. And I learned many, many years ago when I was leading the campaign to protect Mono Lake how important individual choices were to protection of the environment, but more significantly, how we manage water supplies to have healthy communities, resilient communities that will enable us to have the water when we need it, where we need it. But that is always tied back to the impact of our choices on the source of the water. So Mono Lake is a great example of a city that was diverting water from the tributary streams that fed into this ancient lake. It was on the brink of ecological collapse back in 1981. We led a campaign in Los Angeles to bring the people of Los Angeles into the equation of what it meant to protect Mono Lake. And the Mothers of East LA, of Santa Isabel, and many community groups ended up doing literally door-to-door promoting installation of low-flow toilets and other water efficiency devices so that LA could save the water, reduce their own water use, so that water could be dedicated back to the protection of Mono Lake. Not only is Mono Lake saved today as a result of those choices and the choice of LA to maintain a higher lake level at Mono Lake, but today the people of Los Angeles are using less water than they did in the mid-1980s, even though the population has grown by more than 1 million people. So it's a great example of how individual choices really make a difference in creating resilience in the sense that LA has the water it needs, but so does Mono Lake. And so it's a shared vision of resilience that brings the ecological cycle, the watershed, into the conversation about when we talk about resilience, it's across all of the different types of needs, including the environment.
That's so interesting because when you enter the climate conversation and we talk about individual actions versus system change, and there's this stark divide in the climate community about the efficacy of these approaches. And it's not exactly a perfect analog because when you talk about individual actions with regard to climate, we're talking about emitting carbon into a collective atmosphere that is essentially one giant common. Whereas with water, individual actions, maybe you can see a more tangible effect because we're looking at individual watersheds on land. And I think that's a huge difference. And so with water, you really get to see the coming together of the impacts of individual actions and top-down change at once, like the decision of the city of Los Angeles. I want to read a quick clip from Tom Ash, who he's a legendary water visionary. And he passed away a few months ago. And Martha, we know that you were close to Tom, and it can't be easy to hear his voice posthumously. So we're very grateful to you for being up for it. Tom talks about his time managing water in Southern California and how he was able to communicate the cost of water and introduce a sort of higher water awareness through a tiered billing system, which is that's sort of like the top-down approach that we talked about. Let's have a listen to what Tom says.
We're telling water users the wrong story. We're telling them that water's expensive. It's not. It falls out of the sky. Getting that water to where we need it, that's what's expensive. That's the infrastructure. That's what costs. We got to tell people that story. And if you respect your customers, you respect their intellect, you're going to tell them the real story.
Martha, what is the water story that we need to be telling people?
I'd like to start just by honoring Tom. You're right. It's really hard for me to hear his voice. I miss him so much. He was such an extraordinary human, a kind soul, but married to a problem-solving heart. And so, you know, his work, not just in Southern California, but throughout the state, was advocating for ways in which we can make better use of our water supplies and understand the underlying infrastructure of how this precious resource is delivered to our homes and businesses and where we grow food, and the way in which we can both understand the cost of the investments in those systems, but also understand where it comes from. At Mono Lake, we used to say, as we were explaining the circumstances, that Mono Lake is not unique. We have special places at the ends of all of our taps. Some of those places are closer than 350 miles away from the population that it's serving, and that's the Mono Lake story with Los Angeles. But everywhere where we're tapping water, it's coming out of the earth in some way, out of an ecosystem. And there are resources, living resources, that are dependent on those water supplies. So it goes back into the essence of we're sharing a resource, and it puts a special burden on us because we're the ones who have choice over how we manage these water supplies. Now, the other part of Tom's his voice that I just heard is both his respect for the communities that water agencies serve and understanding the challenges that water agencies are facing, the essential cost structure that goes into the great work that water agencies do in making sure that we have clean, reliable water supplies being delivered to our homes. So we frequently talked about that water was free. I mean, it falls out of the sky, but building the pipes and getting it to your, treating it and getting it to your house is not. And so he devised a tool with the Irvine Ranch Water District, but now is being adopted by many agencies to really inform rate structures from the perspective of rewarding those who are the most efficient in using their water supplies with the lowest cost, and identifying where there's waste in the system and structuring a rate around recognizing that waste is occurring, overuse is occurring, and that those customers would pay a higher amount because they're imposing an additional cost on the entire community of making sure that they're getting the water that they're using. And so he could connect the dots between how we are individually using water on our properties and in our homes with the rates that we're paying for the water supplies, and doing it in a way that created equity across all the different users. So there was a real connection and a respect for how much water we were using, whether we were wasting it, whether we could use it better, and the price that we were paying for that water. It was a brilliant system, and at its foundation, it respected the fact that he believed, and I think he's right, people care. People want to ensure that they're not wasting water, that they're not wasting money, but I think they also care about understanding where the water comes from and knowing that their choices make a difference. So he put together a brilliant proposal for how water agencies could adjust their rate structures to make this happen.
So what the tiered rate structure really gets at is reducing consumptive and wasteful use, isn't it? It's how do we get the water customer to a degree of awareness where they can see which behaviors are causing them and reducing the use in those areas. So earlier we talked about the top-down approach versus bottom-up. And if this tiered water rate structure can represent a top-down approach at a utility level, the bottom-up here is the water customer meeting that policy in the middle to achieve water conservation. And so I'm wondering what tools are available for those customers to conserve water.
Tom was a landscaper originally. So he really came at the whole conversation about waste, looking at it from a watershed perspective. And he always saw individual pieces of property, your yard at your home, as part of the larger watershed. And so as he would look at it from the perspective of how are the plants that I've got on my property, how are they, what watering do they need? Do I have plants that are what we would call now climate appropriate, meaning plants that work with the hotter temperatures or the way in which rain falls on our property? Our native plants in particular are designed to work with the hot summers, wet winter pattern that is normal in California. So he focused a lot of his effort. It turns out that for a normal household, an overwhelming percentage of their water use is actually on the outdoor landscaping. I mean, it's literally in the ballpark, depending on where you live, somewhere between 60 and 90% of the water that you use in your home goes to outdoor landscaping, which is extraordinary. So he focused, even though the indoor was really important and he promoted low-flow toilets and the installation of water-efficient devices, his primary focus was on trying to help people see that by making adjustments to their landscaping, just to bring it into, compatibility with the climate in which we live. Focusing on trees for shade, which is important from climate resilience as well, but making sure that we weren't over-irrigating. In fact, I remember when I first got to know him, he used to walk around with a soil corer, which is this kind of stick thing that you could put into your lawn, and he would pull out these soil corers, and he would show me how extraordinarily overwatered these landscapes were, that literally the soil was super saturated with water to the point where it was actually killing the grass. So he would walk around and he'd show me in all these different yards that people really had a choice on their landscaping. And even if they were going to have grass, they could make choices that would not waste so much water. And of course, that connects with this watershed concept of not just using water efficiently in your yard and what you could do to reduce your water footprint. But of course, any yards that are really overwatering, you've got stormwater, you've got runoff. We sometimes call it stormwater, but it's the runoff from the irrigation system, which then creates water quality problems as it runs down the streets and ultimately collects in some sort of a drainage system, a creek, goes out to the ocean and creates pollution problems there. So he was a really big voice for thinking about how all the pieces fit together, but doing it primarily through the lens of landscaping.
I love the vision of Tom going to yards with the soil core and pulling up these oversaturated samples. I'm assuming, was this in Southern California?
Yes, it was. So we were walking around, we were looking at individual properties, we were looking at parks that were irrigated with recycled water, and in some places we'd literally squish our way out to it was a low point in the landscape, and he would show how overactive sprinklers or sprinklers, you know, we see the sprinklers going off during the rain, and he would go, why is that? There's a simple control to keep them from triggering in the rain. But it's just a great example that we haven't been as thoughtful about our landscape irrigation practices and what types of plant materials that we put in the landscapes. And it's a huge frontier for California. And I have to add one more. I worked on a project I loved in Southern California, Garden in Every School. And it was, the whole point was helping kids to connect with native landscapes, food landscapes, their heritage oaks and things like that. But when we did these programs, we would talk about how by making a choice about the plant materials, you can invite birds, butterflies, a whole bunch of native species that are really having a hard time. You can invite them back into your yards. And it's such an interesting vision of our urban future where we can create much more resilient connections between these species that are having such a hard time as they deal with climate change, and actually using our yards either for habitat for these native species or for growing food. Either one, really important part of really connecting with a very different vision of what an urban landscape might look like.
It really strikes me when you talk about how we haven't been as thoughtful as we could be. And when you situate that idea in the place of California, especially Southern California, where there's such a concentration of population that is kind of misaligned with resource availability. When you think about it, California was designed with a water system that relies on transporting water, as we know, from the northern part of the state to Southern California. And so when you talk about the idea that people aren't being as mindful as they could be, it's almost hard to blame them for being disconnected from a system, when it's like, of course they're disconnected from the system. You have millions of people living in a desert type region in Southern California, receiving water from pipes that are underground, that are not visible. And we're asking them to be more water wise. And it's like, well, of course they haven't been as thoughtful. They've been severed from the source of their water for quite some time. And raising that awareness of where their water comes from, the value of it, and the need to realign our systems with the climate that we're situated in.
I so agree with that. Again, the Mono Lake effort taught me so much about how we've created urban systems that are so broken away or disconnected from the source of their water supplies. And the example I would give, I remember early in the campaign, I was walking to the office on a Saturday. I was over in West LA at the time. And as I walked to the office, thinking about the fact that I was being told that there was no way that LA could conserve any water at that point in time, particularly not for Mono Lake. And I came across the street that had a flow of water on it that I could have kayaked for 3 blocks without touching bottom. And I walked up to the source, and it was an irrigation system that was on an institutional property that had gone crazy. So of course, you know, you call the property managers and to get it dealt with, but it had been clearly flowing for a long time. And for all I could do is see it as there's Mono Lake flowing down the street, because it had no value really in the context of what it meant to Mono Lake. And it's those kinds of examples, or the examples of you know, the great work that's been done by the Coast Keepers and Heal the Bay and a number of other groups working along our coasts, recognizing that when we overwater and that water runs through the streets and it runs out into the ocean, all we're doing is polluting the are the beaches and the coastal waterways that we care about. So again, going back to Tom, he always saw these connections and he always wanted to solve the problem of how to help people understand. He wasn't judgmental. He just knew that they were living in a world where those connections were not obvious. So he wanted to talk about it. And he wanted people to see that, again, back to your opening question, their choices mattered. They can make a difference. They matter in their own lives, but they also matter to these other ways in which we are connected to each other and to the natural world.
You know, one observation that Tom made during his 30 years in water comes to mind. He noted that as populations grew, so did the inequities with water. And of course, those inequities occurred across the same fault lines we're familiar with, the ones that produce climate injustice and other societal cleavages. It ends up being those who are already most vulnerable who get the short end of the stick. And the short end of the stick, when it comes to water, can be deadly. Nearly 1 million residents in California lack basic access to clean water. In Tuolumne County, 3,600 residents alone lack access to clean water. That's according to the State Water Board. The coronavirus pandemic forced the state to place a moratorium on water shutoffs, which has really pushed some of these smaller systems that serve some of the state's most outlying and vulnerable residents to the brink of survival, and threatened to leave many residents with significant debt. Tom understood this social injustice of water. Let's play another clip from that interview.
When water rates are raised, it hurts disadvantaged low-income people more. But that's the rate design that most agencies have. And you say, well, that's, you know, the way we've always done it, and that's the way it is, and that's, and the rate consultants give them the same rate structure, just a little higher price every couple of years. So low-income folks really do get the short end of the stick. And people on the other end of the income scale don't care. In fact, their accountants pay for the water bill, pay the bills, and they don't even notice.
Martha, we know that the folks who make up these disadvantaged low-income people are disproportionately comprised of Black, Indigenous, people of color. How does the way we currently use water perpetuate this inequality?
You know, Tom was passionate on this issue, as you heard in his voice. And I'll never forget, he actually went to some researchers and asked them to take a hard look at, out of all the rate structures that were available to water agencies, which ones were the least regressive? And the answer is that it's the rate structure that he's been advocating and working with water agencies on for the last, he worked on it for the last 20 years, of what he called a budget-based budget-based rate structure, which is an increasing block rate structure, but its foundation is in reasonable water use. That's the starting block. What's a reasonable amount of water use? And so when I look back on some of the examples of how disadvantaged communities have been taken advantage of, one example, which I know in Southern California is being dealt with right now, is the reality that we've had programs in place to make rebates available for indoor water use. But most of the people who are able to take advantage of those rebates are more middle class or upper class people. And so it's only recently that water agencies have really started to look at the disparity between who received the rebates for, say, installation of a low flow toilet. The problem is that for the disadvantaged communities, they're typically in the older housing that are using toilets that have the water wasting toilets. So think about the inequity of living in a home that has infrastructure that is wasteful, and yet the water agency hasn't recognized that disadvantage, that you are a part of a community that by definition, even though you don't have very much money, you're paying more for your water because you have built-in inefficiency because of those appliances. Another place where this happens, and it's the way the rate structure gets set up, if a water agency hasn't taken into consideration the fact that when they're building all of their infrastructure, who needs that next increment of infrastructure to be constructed? And one of the most expensive aspects of infrastructure for a water agency is peak water use, which typically occurs late summer, early fall. And the customers that are typically overusing, these are based on studies, are people who do have very large landscapes, typically managed by somebody else, not them. And so, yeah, we're building the system to make sure that they have the reliable water in that hot summer month. But who gets to pay for it? If the rate structure isn't recognizing the difference between infrastructure that is shared by all and infrastructure that's being driven by the most wealthy, then all of a sudden you have the poor paying for that infrastructure. And so those are some of the issues that are challenging and really tie back to understanding our rate structures and what we're paying for and who's benefiting from the infrastructure, whether it's a generalized, everybody shares in the infrastructure, or whether it's for particular communities within the service area. Challenging issues, but Tom was never afraid to take on a challenge. And so his advocacy for the budget-based rate structures was really founded in a belief that we can have fairer rate structures at the same time that we're making sure that we are appropriately paying for the infrastructure we need for the resiliency, for reliability. It's a brilliant idea. In the last drought, a number of agencies really picked it up and started changing their rate structures. And what they discovered was, because you have so much overuse in one portion of the customers that you serve, you can take that money and then reinvest it in their efficiency. So you actually are bringing everybody into alignment over time to what it means to be efficient, to use water efficiently. And instead of having these disparities between different customer classes or the wealthy and not wealthy, you're really moving a system into a system that's equal, that's fairer for everybody.
And then you take some of these solutions, like Tom created this tiered rate structure, and you implement it, and along comes all these unanticipated benefits that address a lot of the things that you just mentioned. It addresses these social inequities. And not just that, it enhances the entire quality of life. It enhances the entire health of our watersheds. Let's return briefly to a clip from Tom where he describes how changing the rate structure healed Newport Bay in Southern California. Let's listen.
We eliminated water runoff down the street that had nitrates, phosphates, pesticides, and herbicides in it that we put onto our landscape to make it green and lush, and it was being washed off by overwatering. And that water was running to Newport Bay and out to the ocean. In 1990, the Newport Bay was heavily polluted with nitrates, algae bloom, fish die off, and that was not a good thing. That bay is part of the Great Pacific Flyway. So here we had a polluted situation surrounded by homes and businesses and landscapes that were causing that problem because of overwatering. And it was the rate structure that changed that dynamic. And now we cut the runoff by 80%. And the non-point source water pollution by about 70% going into the bay. The bay health changed fast.
So Tom here describes how the simple act of changing that tiered rate structure caused this knock-on effect of people starting to become more aware of their water, the cost of that water, starting to limit their use, and thus reducing the amount of pollutants running off into the bay. And one of the things we talk about on the water table and that we implement on the ground at the Watershed Progressive is the idea that there are these multi-benefits that arise out of taking these simple steps, these simple acts, whether it's a shift in a tiered rate structure, or whether it's a shift in your water use, or a shift in the way you've designed your landscape. If you could, Martha, talk a little bit about some of these tools that that you have in your pocket and some of the unanticipated benefits that arise out of it?
Well, let me start by just, that was one of my favorite stories that Tom would tell, because it's such a, people are skeptical, and understandably so, of promises that we're going to save the world if we just do one thing. And yet, the reality is, our choices do make a difference, and when they're implemented at scale, so in this case, Irvine Ranch Water District had changed its rate structure. It affected everybody in the service area. There was a lot of wasteful watering that was going on, and it contributed hugely, obviously, to the pollution problem in Newport Beach. So one thing that's important to think about is we are, all of our landscape is part of a watershed. We're connected to special areas, and when the water flows off of our property, it goes somewhere, and typically it goes to a pretty special area. So it if we start looking at our land and our homes as part of that watershed and what we're connected to, that's where you start then figuring out that these choices to be more efficient, more reasonable in the way that we're using water, but also connected with other choices we're making about our landscape, make a huge difference in terms of quality of life for ourselves and quality of life for our community. So there's a lot of things that are so interesting in you know, what are some of the unexpected, maybe unanticipated consequences of really changing our management strategies. And you've got a couple of them just in the story that you just told. Number one, we use a lot of polluting things on our properties to promote the growth of certain types of landscaping. And lawns tend to be the most challenging because they take a lot of fertilizer products and pesticides and other things. So we're actually polluting our own landscape when we use those chemicals. We can really reduce the toxicity around our homes by not doing that. I made an earlier reference to the importance of planting climate appropriate and native plants from the standpoint of creating habitat and inviting back in parts of the wild world that actually are losing traction. You know, who doesn't want hummingbirds in their yard, right? And all sorts of birds in the yard. So that's a great asset. The another opportunity that I think is so interesting really is in the stormwater, rainwater space, both in terms of being able to capture. So whether you're doing rainwater capture off your roof, it's really great water that you can add for, you know, resilience during drought years and having that water available. But really the other part that you're doing is you're starting to think of the hydrology of your own site, and you can connect with gray water systems where you can take water from your laundry, water from your showers, and have that going into the yard rather than depending on the water that would come through your pipes. So there's so many different things. The climate change type of plants that you have, you can plant for shade, much more effective than having a lawn around your house. And shade will really make a difference as temperatures go up during the summer months. That's going to be one of the bigger pushes you'll see in the urban area, is how do we restore a tree canopy that will help reduce some of the temperature on our homes. So there's so many different ways in which our landscapes and the choices that we make on these landscapes are really connected to both helping to protect upstream resources as well as be a really important part of the quality of life of our community and protect downstream resources.
Martha, thank you so much for joining us on the Water Table. This conversation was enlightening for us, and it was also a beautiful tribute to your friend Tom, our friend Tom, and we're very grateful for you for joining us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for making this podcast in Tom's memory. Like I said at the beginning of the show, I think about him every day. I think about what would Tom say or do, and I know how much this would mean to him. So thank you very much.
We'd like to acknowledge the Department of Water Resources and the Tuolumne County Resource Conservation District, as well as the residents of California, whose support of Prop 84 made this podcast possible. Thank you to Ryan Evans for editing and mixing. Our theme music was done by Todd Hannigan. Thank you to Charles Upton, who recorded the original interview with Tom Ashe, which ended up being so, so special. The full original interview and transcript with Tom are available on www.watertoolkit.org. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Water Table.